Hey everyone, it is Pablo. Today is Wednesday, December 29th, still 2021. And I hope you're enjoying this week's slate of episodes. They're some of our favorites that we've run from the past year. And today, we're giving you an exclusive interview that first ran in October. And it gave us a view behind the scenes of a super dysfunctional NBA team that's unlike any I had ever heard before. And just some fair warning in advance here. This episode contains strong language. Today, I want to introduce you to a man who has led one of the most fascinating lives in all of sports, a man named Bob Vulgaris.
I was an NBA bettor. I bet on the NBA. Hundreds of millions. You added it all up. Never really had a losing year.
Bob parlayed a skill for betting on NBA games into a full-time, high-level job in the front office of an NBA team, running the analytics department of the Dallas Mavericks. It turned out to be more than just a jolt to the team's system.
I mean, look, I'm an acquired taste, I get that.
Which is what owner Mark Cuban said he wanted. But tensions reportedly escalated between Bob, the laptop-toting outsider, the so-called gambler, and general manager Donnie Nelson, which all led to headlines accusing Bob of jeopardizing the team's relationship with superstar Luka Doncic. So we bring you an exclusive interview with Bob Vulgaris, who answers questions for the first time about whether he really was the shadow GM of the Mavericks.
I didn't know I was going to be running the draft. I don't think it was anyone's plan for me to be running the draft. But when it came time to pick 18, the general manager of the team wasn't around.
Wait, where was Donnie Nelson?
I don't know.
And what it's really like when a culture war consumes an NBA team. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Thursday, October 21st. This is ESPN Daily. Bob Vulgaris, welcome to ESPN Daily, man. Thank you for joining me.
Hey, thanks, Pablo. Thanks for having me.
You were the alleged, and we'll get into the alleged aspect of this, the alleged shadow general manager of the Dallas Mavericks. You found yourself at the center of this power struggle, a public power struggle slash culture war also over the summer that involved Mark Cuban and Luka Doncic and the departures of both you and the formal GM, Donnie Nelson, and the head coach, Rick Carlisle. We'll disentangle all of that as best we can. You're already smiling because I think there are things that you want to say, but you haven't said anything yet, Bob. On the record, you haven't done any interviews, you haven't commented on this stuff with a journalist like me until today. So why are you here talking to me, man?
Well, first off, I was smiling just because when you put it the way you put it, it does seem kind of ridiculous. I never really thought about it in that way. But when it's framed that way, yeah, it sounds almost like a telenovela.
Yeah.
Why am I don't know. I think part of it is I do think that I would like to have my side of the story told a little bit. Didn't really feel like doing an interview or writing anything. Podcasts seem to be the venue. Respect your work, obviously. So yeah, why not?
No, I respect that you respect my work, and I'll try to do justice to you by unpacking all of this stuff as best we can here, Bob. And I think that means that we got to start with something closer to the beginning of your career in sports betting, because I think people need to understand what it means when I say that you are one of the world's most notable sports gamblers. I mean, you've been known as the gambler now in NBA press, but like, let's start it this way. How much money would you say that you've made betting on sports?
You came right. I wasn't a sports gambler. I was an NBA bettor. I bet on the NBA. So I dabbled in other sports, but primarily my bread was buttered on betting on NBA basketball. So when someone refers to me as a gambler, that's somewhat accurate, not quite accurate. But how much money? I don't know. I did it for 15 to 18 years, hundreds of millions, I would say, if you added it all up. Not a small amount. Never really had a losing year.
Wait, so hundreds of millions of dollars, that is staggering. I mean, that's absurd on some level, Bob.
It isn't. But when you think about you do it for 20 years or 18 years, it's not that. I mean, it's impressive, but it's not that impressive. There's guys who have made billions of dollars in betting on European football. So yeah, it's impressive, but maybe not as impressive when you look at to stretch out over time.
Well, let's actually get into why you chose to focus on basketball in specific. How did you arrive at this being your niche?
Kind of by happenstance. I took a gap year between college and university. My dad was he was a degenerate gambler. At the time I was like, I don't really want to call him a degenerate, but he was a degenerate gambler. Definitely a failed gambler. He was in Las Vegas during that time. And so I went and visited him and stayed with him at Caesar's Palace for 3 to 4 months during the NBA season. Under the age of 21, couldn't really hang out in the casino and do anything, but I could kind of just mind my own business in the sports book and not get bothered too much. He'd give me like a couple $100 to bet on games. I liked basketball before then, but that's when I really started to think like, oh, this is something I could do. There's not a whole lot to do in Vegas, especially during that time period when you're underage and you don't really know anyone. And so watching basketball was just a natural thing for me.
Wait, so you're a hardcore basketball fan before all of this, but then you're sort of watching the games. And when does it occur to you that you could develop at some point some sort of an edge in how you were seeing the game?
I think around that time, obviously, this is 1993, I believe, 93, 94. Obviously, I didn't really know what I was doing. I didn't know that there could be an edge. Look, when you're in these sports books, people are yelling and screaming, getting upset, being very emotional about their bets. And that's just not me. So I thought, okay, at least I have that going for me. I'm not making irrational decisions based on being an irrational human being. And then I just kind of watched and started to really fall in love with the game. And then the more I got into it, the more I realized, oh, this is something that I want to get good at. And so I became obsessive about trying to beat this, be successful at it. I think I have a natural ability to like recognize patterns, to look at things from a calculated standpoint. I noticed something very specific with a few different coaches and how they approach the game. I felt like I had a really good handle on them and I focused my attention on them. The most simple edge I can remember that was really big when we were modeling was there was a year where Kobe was injured and he was coming in and out of the lineup for the Lakers, and his value in the market, what the market valued him at versus what most of the models valued him at, widely different, like wildly different. And that doesn't say so much about something to disparage Kobe. It's just the market thought he was worth X amount of points. The team actually, you could argue, played better without him during the regular season because it was like more of a brute force Shaq effect. So that was one edge that we had. I think around the same time, maybe that year or the following year, I think Steve Francis had like these, you know, recurring migraines. And so like not just the press conferences, but like the pregame pressers to know which players are available. There wasn't Twitter back then, so you had to really work hard for the information, like listening to like real audio press conferences, streaming press conferences, local radio. That's all the stuff. You're just collecting as much information as you can and sticking it all into your mind to kind of glean any edge you can.
Over the years, Bob Vulgaris' approach evolved, initially instigated by a change in the sport. He remembers the NBA releasing its play-by-play data around the turn of the century for the first time. And he says he went from keeping highly detailed basketball journals and reading every article and monitoring coaches' press conferences to building these increasingly sophisticated quantitative models that took advantage of this surge in highly detailed information.
I mean, the NBA is a pretty cool sport. The amount of the high level of data that you could get even back then was pretty high. Now there's cameras in the court taking a picture of the court 20 some odd times a second. So it's
yes,
really rich data sets, large data sets. And so that there was always something more. That was the cool thing about it. The game never got stale because it was always changing, always evolving, and the data sets were always improving.
And when Twitter came into existence, Bob was on there. He was very vocal online, starting in the late aughts, live tweeting games, killing coaches for in-game decisions, analyzing the huge Tim Donaghy refereeing scandal. And ultimately, he won attention from inside the NBA. In 2010, in fact, Bob says he quit gambling because an NBA owner paid him to work as a consultant, running simulation models, advising on trades. And that owner, he says now, was Mark Cuban, owner of the Mavericks, which set him on a different course. Why were you into this? Why did you want to get inside an NBA team like that?
Gambling's boring. You do the same thing. At that point, it was, look, here's what I'll say about betting on basketball. It is the type of thing where if I applied myself to finance, open markets, I would have made much more money. I am dealing with, in some cases, not in all cases, the scum of the earth to make these bets, to get these bets down. You're dealing with like guys who are Goomba. I've dealt with like mafia guys from Montreal. I've dealt with like all different types of people. And the battle in betting is can you pick winners and can you get your bets on? And getting your bets on involves you taking on partnerships, getting beards, finding people to make your bets for you. If I were to open a bet, an account in my name, the sportsbook's never going to want to take my bets.
That's Bob nodding to this reality that once you become known as the guy making really good money betting on sports, the sportsbook wises up pretty quick and basically just says, no thank you, which they are totally allowed to do. But then there's also the basic fact that betting isn't a normal regulated business in the first place.
You're getting stiffed a lot. People are not paying you. People are stiffing you. You have no recourse. What are you going to do? That was a part of it.
You can't call the cops, right? You can't like.
Yeah. I mean, I had a guy run off with, I think a third of my betting bankroll, whatever was left of it that one year. Just like the guy who was running all my betting stuff for me.
So you're continuing gravitating towards actual on the books NBA work, Bob. And then in 2018, you go full time. You become the Mavericks director of quantitative research and analysis. And I have questions related to this move. Like, how did the transition from consultant to full-time staffer in the front office, how did that come about? How did that particular title get decided on?
So 2 years as a consultant, worked with them through the draft. The first draft didn't have that much involvement. Luka's draft definitely was involved in that. I was pushing very hard to draft this player. I told Mark that I would consider working for the team full-time, not as a consultant, but full-time. If they were able to pull off the deal, he did. And
oh, wait, that's the pull off the deal to draft Luka Doncic.
Correct. Yeah. I know other people liked him as well in the organization. Donnie obviously liked him. But part of the gig is convincing Mark to about something. And I think Mark, you know, trusted Donnie, I'm sure, to some extent. But
Donnie Nelson, the longtime GM of the team, yes.
Correct.
Yes.
Yeah. Their draft record was not great prior to that Luka Doncic draft pick, just to be fair. And so, yeah, that was a big part of it for me. That was, I wasn't going to move to Dallas to watch the current team that they had play, but to be around who I thought was a future MVP candidate, which I think is in my interactions with him and my correspondence with him. I said that, that was exciting to me. So who came up with the title of director? I did, because I was like, what is the title? What is the job title? I need to apply for a visa in order to do this. I'm not American. So that was the title we came up with. I think what was my actual role? It was unclear in some ways.
So Bob, by the way, is Greek Canadian. He was living in Monaco at the time and he had paperwork to fill out that basically would declare that he's going to do this job in the United States of America. And the job's title is Director of Quantitative Research and Development for the Dallas Mavericks, an analytics job, basically. But if the reality of what that job actually entailed was at all vague around seniority or power, I wondered how the rest of the team's leadership would react to him. And so he told me about the first time he met general manager Donnie Nelson years before as a consultant.
I got deposited into Donnie's office and he had no idea who I was. And coach is like, oh, I'm about to start practice. Hey, have you met Donnie yet? Let's go say hello to Donnie. I get deposited into Donnie's office. And it was pretty, you know, what's going on? Hey, what's up? What do you do? I hate the word analytics, but kind of analytics. Cool. Okay. Nothing was said for the next three, felt like the longest 5 minutes of my life. And it might only been a minute and a half. I leave to go watch practice, I guess, just because it's awkward. And then some guy who was working for Donnie named Max knew who I was. He's like, oh, that's Bob the gambler, Bob the guy, whatever, you know, Corrala Bob. And so he comes and pulls, I guess, something, I don't know what was said, but pulls me back in. And now Donnie's like super interested in meeting me because he's trying to sell me like a futsal franchise and a Mexican G League team and some other stuff. And that was it. And that was kind of like the impetus of how things kind of came about.
So the person tasked with building out the roster didn't seem especially serious about or even interested in Bob and his years of basketball expertise.
Here's the thing I'll say about the Mavericks. As much as I can talk about possible dysfunction, disorganization. I mean, the name is perfect, right? Maverick, it's a maverick. Like, in order for me, I would not be hired by a team. No other team was going to hire me in that capacity or take the step to hire me unless they had the issues that made it difficult for me to succeed. Does that make sense? Like the dysfunction, willing to go, you know, let's try something new, not like a really big, like a lot of other teams are interested at. The first team I ever met with was someone from the Boston Celtics the year after they won the NBA championship. I met with someone in their front office. I met with Daryl Morey and Sam Hinkie 1 year at Summer League. You know, everyone was like, can we hire this gambler? What is the league going to think about this? Now you can't watch a game without seeing the fucking tickers on the bottom. I mean, the Mavericks games are on Bally Sports Network, which is a casino sport gambling environment. So it's just different, it's completely different.
So Mark Cuban being the owner of the team, the guy who sought your counsel, the guy who brought you in this role that you got to title, but did not actually define what the role specifically would mean. It sounds like you had a direct line to Mark.
For sure.
And I'm curious, how would you describe that? Yeah.
Yeah. It's unfair to say that a role wasn't defined. Like I was clear what I was, I mean, he made it very clear to me what he wanted me to do, which was,
what did he want you to do?
It was more along the lines of we're deficient in certain areas. I don't want you to fit in. I mean, I sent him an email where I was like, hey, look, I'll just try to fit in. I appreciate the opportunity. Like, I don't want to ruffle any feathers. And he was very clear, like, no, I don't want you to fit in. We're deficient in areas that you're good at. If it's hard and hard conversations have to be had, then you. So it was kind of like, I was like this missile to kind of go in there and create like the change that like unlock some boulders or whatever that couldn't have been moved before. You know, I think even in the email, one of the things that was in there was, yeah, just be yourself, but don't fall in line. I'm not interested in that. You're good at what you are good at. Own that. And I believe in you was what he basically said.
He wanted you to be a maverick in so many ways.
He wanted me to be a maverick in some ways. Yeah. But to be clear, my involvement with the organization was almost, I spoke more to Coach Carlisle than anyone else. That's who I mostly communicated with. I had what I thought was a great relationship with him. I'm sure he would characterize it as in a similar fashion, but I don't want to speak for him. I respected him, obviously, still do. But that was the guy I mostly dealt with. I didn't have a working relationship with other people in the front office at all, to the point where it was awkward. But that's kind of the MO of the way that front office was run. Like, surround yourself with people who are not threats. Part of the, you know, you don't become an NBA general manager and hold on to your job for that long unless you are very, very good at keeping your job. And what does that entail? You know, there's some people approach it one way, other people approach it another way. I think if you look at the Mavericks, there isn't anyone who really worked in the Mavericks front office and has a job working in another team's front office. There is no Mavericks tree for front offices. Whereas if you look at the Spurs and the Rockets and these other teams, they're spread all over the league, even Denver to a certain extent. There isn't that for Dallas. And that's because I think that was a concerted thing that the powers and the people who are in charge really wanted to hold on to. Let's surround ourselves with people who are not threats. If they are a threat, let's get rid of them.
Wait, so this is where we start to get into what The Athletic reported earlier this year about tensions coming to a head between you and Donnie Nelson, among others. So how would you describe your working relationship with Donnie Nelson?
I didn't have a working relationship with Donnie Nelson. I mean, I think Mark had this idea that maybe we could work together. You know, he the stuff that he's good at, I might be deficient at, and vice versa. You know, he's more of a kind of like a wheeler dealer. Like, when you shake his hands, you want to make sure your rings are still there. Like, not in a bad way, but just he's that guy. Like, he's a guy who wants to do, he's a deal maker. He's a bro. Like, here, my interaction with my working relationship with Donnie Nelson was seeing him every once in a while and getting a fist bump. That was it. Like, you know, whether it was a fist bump text message or a fist bump in person, that was just his thing. Like, what's up? He was very nice and cordial to my face. I think threatened by me though, just perfectly. And he, you know, to his credit, I think there should have been more of a proper structure of like what was happening, who was this guy, how, you know, technically in my contract, I had to report to him, but I never, ever reported to him. Does that make sense?
So the reality of the org chart was not what the org chart said on paper.
Yeah. I mean, look, the org chart is, it's Mark's team. Mark has earned the right to run his team the way he wants to. He's the end lead. That's not, and by the way, that's not unique to the Dallas Mavericks. Plenty of owners run the teams the same way. when it came to trade stuff, I would talk to Mark about stuff, and then he would go off and then things would happen from there. I'm not sure exactly how it would happen, but they would happen.
Wait, so in terms of how you and Donnie saw the building of a team or the management of a team differently, what are some of the things that you guys didn't see eye to eye on, like philosophically?
I don't know, because I didn't really have these conversations with him. Like there was a few here and there. It wasn't bad. It wasn't like it was like an acrimonious relationship. There just wasn't any, my impression of him was he was like stuck in 2012. And that's not a bad thing necessarily. It's just the game changes so much. I mean, the numbers that have changed in the last 5 or 6 years with the prevalence of spacing and the three-point shot, how the three-point shot is even taken, and the difference in catch and shoot versus pull up. The game has changed a lot. And I don't think necessarily anyone in that organization was as cognizant of it as maybe as I thought they should have been.
So the idea that you come in and you have strong views on how to modernize this NBA team, and it has to do with spacing on the floor and threes and understanding the math of the game better. How was that received when you tried to implement this sort of philosophy as a new one that should actually be part of the strategy here?
I mean, look, Coach Carlisle liked having me around. He liked the information. He wanted a different viewpoint. So how was it received? I think for the most part, it was received. They liked it. They considered it. And so how it was received, I don't know. I mean, I think with skepticism, but nobody would treat anything I said as the gospel, as they shouldn't. They're like a measured approach. This is what he thinks. Let's think about it. I'm sure he talked about it with his other coaching staff, rest of his coaching staff. You know, Mark was probably consulted as he was on nearly everything that happened in the organization. I don't know. I think it was received well. I never really thought about that or cared. I just would send emails and I would send a report. Someone would ask me to do something. I would do it. I would give an opinion on something. And sometimes it would happen and sometimes it wouldn't. And it didn't really bother me either way, whether it happened or not, unless I felt really, really strongly about it, in which case I'd probably follow up with another email or two or three or four. I wasn't trying to change too much. I just want to make that very clear. Like, I wanted to be a part of something. I wanted to win basketball games. Changing the organizational structure of the Dallas Mavericks was never something I was interested in unless I was going to be the guy in charge. And I wasn't even sure. I never actually wanted to be the guy in charge until it became clear that the guy in charge didn't want me around. And then I was like, oh, okay. Now it's competitive. Just to be very clear, first 2 years, whatever, Donnie was very pleasant around me when I was there. It's just, you hear certain things, you learn certain things, you're told certain things. It was a very gossipy workplace, very gossipy. It was like a sewing circle over there.
Well, that all makes sense, but this is sounding, Bob, like from your description and from others reporting, it sounds almost like a Game of Thrones level of backbiting and dysfunction and competing for power and for Mark's ear.
Yeah.
When do you remember the moment when you were like, oh, this is how this place works?
Yeah, I think probably what ended up happening when it started to get more obvious was when there were no fans in the building. And I had mentioned that we didn't have any floor seats, like portable, those little chairs. We didn't have any of those at our games for us to watch. And other places you'd go to, I was like, what a treat. You know, I get to sit here because Donnie wasn't on the road, but I was, because of COVID, et cetera. And so I think when I started sitting in that seat and then I would look over and the other GM of the team is sitting in that seat, I think that's when things started to get like heightened around them. I just wanted to sit there and watch a game. I wasn't thinking, look at me. I was just like, this is the best spot for me to watch the game and learn something about the game and impart some wisdom or whatever, or, you know, if I'm going to go to a game, I want to be as close as possible, or I want to watch it on TV. I would hear from other people too, that I knew around the league, like, oh, I hear you're running things. And I would just be like, in my mind, I would just be like, you know, Mark runs things. Like, Mark is always running things. Maybe that's not true now, but it certainly was while I was there.
Well, the idea of you perhaps obliviously, naively, even per your description there, like winding up in this power chair on the court. I mean, Bob, you sitting courtside is a big part of the Athletics reporting that we got to disentangle here, because all of this tension, I mean, the way that this blew up in NBA media surrounds, of course, Luka Doncic, who is, like, by all intents and purposes, like the actual power center of this team. He's 22 years. Yeah.
Yeah, that was a big part of it. Me sitting there was a big part of it, because you know, the players didn't really know what was happening either. Like, who is this? Like, they'd seen me around, but I the idea that I was like, so this isn't that I was around the team and I was telling players what to do. And that's just nonsense. Never talked to a player about anything unless a coach pulled me over and was like, hey, Bob, what is that? Can you explain something here? So me going out of my way to tell players how to, like, the best players in the world, how to play a sport that I am not qualified to talk, that didn't happen.
I want to walk people through what was reported in The Athletic as it concerns Luka Doncic, Bob. The Athletic reported that this past February, during a game, you allegedly gestured to Luka to calm down. And he responded with this quote, quote, "Don't fucking tell me to calm down." So that anecdote, bring me into that scene. Tell me what actually happened as you experienced it.
Okay. So leading up to that, we have a very barky team. And I don't know, do you have any dogs or, but like, if you have two barking dogs in a room, one barks, the other one barks. So I was always the person sitting next to me at all of these games was Mark. Mark talks, he talks to the referees, he talks to the players, he's like, talks to our players, talks to our team's players. And just to bring it a little bit more clear, like, yeah. I am a statue at these games. Like, I was told by like our team athletic trainer, like, hey, like, maybe it'd help if you'd clap a little bit more. Like, some of the guys see you as like this, you know, this judging, whatever, you're not like human to them. Like, you need to make yourself more, don't bring your computer around so much. And so I sat there, and at this point, Luka turned the ball over, threw it out of bounds. Mark was yelling because Luka turned the ball over. I never said anything. I know for a fact, I just not my style. I looked over at Mark and I was like, I think Mark told Luka to calm down or slow down or whatever. And Luka just started yelling at me. And I pulled my mask down. I was like, what is going on here? Why is he yelling at me? But it wasn't, it was directed towards me, but I didn't do anything. So at that point, he might've already decided he didn't like me for some other reason, but for him to yell at me because I told him to calm down, that's just not what happened. And what I thought was really disappointing about that story was the fact that they reported it as such. Everyone in the organization knew that I didn't tell him to calm down. I didn't gesture. I mean, if I made a hands down gesture to someone, it was to Mark, like, yo, buddy, like, calm down. Like, relax.
Like, the calm down gesture, like, pump the brakes kind of a deal.
Yeah. Why am I going to tell Luka Doncic to do anything? Like, I can't say this enough. Like, it's just, you won't find anyone in the organization who can say like, oh yeah, Bob really had a really, I mean, I was capping for this player. Like, you would not believe. Some guys wanted to tell him to stop taking step back threes his rookie season. I wrote like this giant report on why it was, I disagreed with it. I cannot understate how much I loved watching this player play basketball. Loved, like, everything about it, everything, you know. So the idea that I would ever tell him of all people to calm down is absurd. So that disappointed me. Nobody had the courage to go up to him because people walked around him very delicately because he was the figure of the franchise.
All right, after the break, how another incident between Bob and Luka made Bob realize that his time with the team was likely coming to an end.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home some huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
So, Bob, what happened next with you and Luka?
Around the team, people had said that it was so bad that Luka confronted me in the parking garage and we almost came to blows. All nonsense. It never happened. I never even remotely happened. Fast forward a week later or so, whenever we were on the road in New York, it was me and him waiting for an elevator at the Equinox Hotel. Like, and I said to him, I was like, hey, Luca, you know, like I never, and he was very, very quick to say, yeah, I know it was Mark. I know you didn't say anything. And then I basically told him like that one of the main reasons why I'm here is because I get to watch you play. Like I would never begin to tell you how to play. I love the way you play. Like seeing you grow as a basketball player and a human being is like inspiring to me. Like I'm so proud to be a part of this. And it wasn't bullshit. It was really true because I honestly would not have taken the job if he wasn't on the team. It's just not that exciting. But being around this guy is exciting. You can, I mean, it's just palpable. The excitement is so palpable. Being in a position to be around that, to attach yourself to that, was appealing to me. Luca had so much power that he didn't even know he had, or maybe he knew, but he never chose to wield it because he's not that type of guy. He's just a very, like, look, everybody in the facility loved him. He would take his time to sign every, like, just a great human being. Temperamental on the court, feisty, whatever, but that's what makes him, you know, that's off the court, around people, not a diva in any way, not even a little bit of a diva. And so nothing happened after that, aside from like Mark moved his seat. He no longer sat next to me after that. And so it was just me now on an island now, really by myself.
So all of that is prelude to April, which is another incident that The Athletic reported. I need you to explain what happened there, Bob, because this is apparently Luka Doncic telling his teammates that you, Bob Vulgaris, quit on them because you left the arena shortly before the end of the game. And so how do you explain that story in all of this?
I would get up and leave with 30 to 40 seconds left in the half, and frequently at the end of the game, because my office is a trek away from where I work, is a trek away from the court. I was told not to bring my computer around, so my computer was at my office, was in my office. So I would meet with the coaching staff directly after the game, every game. Sometimes I wanted to check something on the computer. I got a call that night from Coach Carlisle. I'm like, did you know what happened? Did you hear what happened? And I was just like, no. Well, Luca was upset that you got up and left early. I was like, what did people say? Well, nobody said anything. I was like, what do you mean nobody said anything? Why wouldn't someone say like, Bob didn't quit on the team? Like I wasn't quit. I mean, it's just the idea that I was upset that we were losing and I quit on the team is, I mean, you can feel that. And I'm not discounting his, but it wasn't how I wasn't upset that we were losing. And the fact that it became a big deal led me to believe that this is just not worth it to me. I was just like, I told Coach Paul, like, I'm done. Like, I don't need to be around this team anymore. I can leave. I will gladly work remote, gladly not work anymore. I am personally offended that nobody stood up for me and said, Bob is here working hard, because I was working hard. So it bothered me a lot. That bothered me a lot. The part that I've never told anyone else is the next day, the next game we had, I walk out to the, during pregame warmups, and one of our assistants is working out one of our players one-on-one. And this, I mean, this I can't be certain of if it was directed towards me. It felt like it was directed towards me, but immediately it turned into a hand clapping, feet stomping, like we play till the final whistle. We never quit. Don't ever quit on the game. Like we ain't done yet. Let's go. Cause they're playing a game of one-on-one. And I looked over at another guy who was a player development coach who I had a good relationship with. And I was just like, yeah, I'm done. And that was it. I basically told Coach Carlisle that I was done traveling with the team, being around the team. You want me to continue working? Happy to do it. If you don't, happy to do that too. He valued the information. He wanted me to continue working. The next day I left, got a phone call from Mark, which I didn't get. I maybe got like four or five of those a year, and it wasn't very often. You know, hey, how you doing? Like just making sure that I didn't quit, basically. I think, in my opinion. And then I worked remote for the rest of the year. And that was that.
So The Athletic reported about this alleged rift between the star player and his team. And as Tim Cato and Sam Amick wrote, quote, there are concerns the front office's dysfunction has hurt its ability to build a contending team around Doncic, and that poor relationships Doncic has with key members of the franchise, including Vulgaris, could impact his current desire to remain in Dallas long term, end quote. And I asked Bob for his thoughts about that claim. I'm just curious when you began to feel that you were this boogeyman upon which things could be pegged and blamed.
I mean, younger me would have been like, wow, I'm so important that this guy's going to turn down $100 and some odd million. Like it was nonsense. I mean, he signed a supermax and I still was being courted by the team to continue working for the team. So I don't know. I'm not sure. I'm not sure what the deal is because I didn't have any contact with him or his camp, or I didn't know what was going on.
So that's in August when Lucas signs that new long-term Supermax deal with the Mavericks, regardless of whatever was happening with your status with the team at the time. But what about things between you and the rest of the locker room?
I liked a lot of the players personally. Like, they were all good dudes. We had all good dudes on the team. When I first got there, there were people who thought that they weren't playing because of me, because of the numbers I was providing. It was never personal, ever. It's just, this is what I think gives us the best chance to win. Now, this is something that I would say in an email, but I don't know how they would get this information. There was the boogeyman aspect, but I think there was other, the thing I underestimated was how competitive this industry is in general, and how catty and Machiavellian people could be, and how, you know, assistants are trying to get head coaching jobs in the league. People in the front office are trying to keep their job. Like, there's a lot of stuff. Players on the last year of their contract are trying to make sure they get one more contract. So there was a couple of different instances where players, a couple of different approached me and said, like, they know that I'm trying to the reason why I'm trying to trade this player.
Tell me about that, Bob. What do you remember happening? Like, as an example of how an NBA ecosystem actually works.
Courtney Lee was definitely one player who thought he wasn't playing because of me.
Courtney Lee, who was traded to the Mavericks in 2019 from the Knicks.
To be fair, I didn't think he should have been playing a lot. That's just nothing personal. Just, I didn't think he gave us the best chance to win.
And one night after the coaching staff opted to start another player over Lee at the last minute for matchup reasons, Bob says that Lee approached him.
He came up to me and he's like, good sub. And I'm like, what? He's like, good sub. Like, kind of like, what's up, but not. And I'm like, what is that? I'm like, what does that mean? And so I look over at Seth. I'm like, what is he saying?
Seth being Seth Curry.
And Seth goes, he's saying good sub. And I was like, oh, this guy really thinks that I'm the reason why. That's how it was a little bit. So that's like the boogeyman aspect of it.
The Athletic cited multiple sources who claimed Bob was dictating lineups and rotation patterns to head coach Rick Carlisle directly. Bob denies this, but he says players kept alluding to his influence over the roster.
He's also a guy who came up to me and he was like, yo, I'm still here. I know you've been trying to get rid of me all year and I'm still here. And I was just like, what is this guy talking about? He's a 12, 13 man on the roster. Why would I try to get rid of him? I didn't. And so I was like, well, no, that's not true. In fact, I actually had sent an email saying hey, he's a pretty good locker room guy. If I have a vote in this, I'm not sure I do. I would advocate keeping him over keeping the other guy who ended up cutting, I think it was Ryan Brokoff. So I was like, no, that's not true. And then they responded with, well, I know you've been trying to trade Jalen all year. And I was just like, what?
This is Jalen Brunson.
Yeah. And I was like, who told you that? And he's like, well, I know that. And then, he told me how he knew. And look, I like Jalen Brunson. Jalen Brunson's a great player. When I look at our roster, we had very few tradable assets that other teams would value. But to say that I was trying to trade him is not true at all. But I think what happened one time is the previous draft, I was trying desperately to we didn't have a draft, first round draft pick. And I was like, how can we get a first round draft pick? We want to get in this draft. There's a player I wanted to draft, Matisse Thybulle. I think one of the guys was like, we just can't get a first round pick. It's impossible unless we trade Jalen Brunson. And they started laughing. And I was just like, wait, I mean, can we think about that for a second? I'm not saying I want to, but can we think about that for a second? That was, I think, where the impetus came, where people now thought I was actively trying to trade Jalen Brunson, which I really wasn't. I just thought if we can get a wing defender, we're deficient wing defenders. By the way, wing defenders are the most valuable commodities in the league. I was trying to get Robert Covington a couple years prior to that for a first round pick. We didn't have any first round picks. There's more guards in the world than there are 6'8", 6'7" wings. So it never had occurred to me that people would be talking about stuff like this. How would you want to tell a player this? Even if your purpose is to make me the villain, you're still messing with this person's psyche. And it's a human being who has to perform at a high level. How is that helping him perform? It kind of alerted me to the fact that this is something that I'm not necessarily cut out for, in the sense that I don't want to be a part of this type of thing, unless I'm in charge of everything and I can control the whole thing. But that's a whole different story.
The notion that Bob Vulgaris, this outsider turned insider, was now trying to banish people from the team, that was apparently a recurring theme during his time there, and also a running joke. In fact, one of the first in-person meetings Bob had with Rick Carlisle was remarkably blunt along those lines.
One day, Coach Carlisle pulls up in a meeting, is like, You know, Bob tried to get me fired in 2010. And I was just like absolutely floored by this. Like, what is this guy talking about?
It turned out Coach Carlisle was referencing an email Bob had sent to owner Mark Cuban back when Bob was working for the team as a remote consultant back in 2010. In the email, Bob says, he'd questioned the team's defensive strategy against Portland's Andre Miller, who had just scored 52 points against the Mavs.
He remembers this fucking email from 11 years prior. And so the next day I went and found the email and I was like, is this the email you're talking about? So, yeah, that's the one. You tried to get me fired. I was like, look, there's nothing in here.
Bob says the email was actually pretty innocuous and that Carlisle was clearly joking with him, messing with him. The coach had already signed off personally, for the record, on hiring Bob to this new full-time role. But I wanted to better understand how their work relationship actually worked.
Well, I'm curious, though, what he wanted from you, what Rick actually did value that you were providing, how you were adding value, what edge you were giving him, and like how that applied, especially in like the postseason. Like, how would you work with him on that?
Just no normal stuff. Like, this is what I think. These are the lineups I think that'll work against this player, this matchup. But just suggest, like, here are some suggestions.
Bob felt like some of his most crucial suggestions related to how the Mavericks matched up against the LA Clippers, who they faced in the first round of the playoffs both of the past two seasons.
Even going back to the previous year, my nightmare was that they would go small versus us. We never defended well versus a small team. We never had the ability to punish a team that went small versus us. There was numerous occasions throughout the year, you can go back and look at them, where a team went closed small versus our predominant, like our average lineup, our normal lineup, go-to lineup, and we just had trouble defending them. So that was kind of the stuff that I would bring up, you know, just different situations, different scenarios, what players match up really well. Like, we had a situation where someone in my department actually noticed this. One of the film guys in my department noticed that they put Nicholas Batum on Jalen Brunson and that was it. We just couldn't, we had to get him off of that matchup because Nicholas Batum did a really good job defending Jalen Brunson. So can we stagger Jalen's minutes so he's not playing? If he's there, can we try to get him off? Can we put another player out who Nicholas Batum will be forced to guard? Those are the types of things you do, but that's not unique to me or any, that's just what I'm guessing analytics departments do. I think I'm different because I believe I have a great, like a long history of predicting these sorts of things and being profitable. So I just presented information and I wasn't in the meetings. I wasn't around. It was all done over email or over telephone with Coach Carlisle. He would always initiate the conversations. I would send it off and we would talk a lot. I mean, we definitely had a good working relationship. We would talk a lot.
One especially pivotal topic of conversation, especially around that Clippers series, would be Kristaps Porzingis, the 7'3" center who came to the Mavericks in 2019 after Donnie Nelson sent two first-round draft picks to the Knicks in a huge multiplayer trade. Porzingis had been acquired to be the second star in Dallas alongside Luka Doncic. But come playoff time on offense, Porzingis was conspicuously asked to stand off in the corner.
I'm curious specifically with this team, how does Kristaps Porzingis fit into how you saw this team functioning at its best, particularly in the postseason?
Kristaps has a lot of talent. I had a good working, like a good relationship in terms of like friendly. He'd ask me questions about crypto, et cetera. I like him as a person. I like him as a basketball player. I just thought that once they went small, we had to approach offense a little bit differently. It's not about making Kristaps a decoy. It's whoever the fuck Kawhi is guarding needs to space out because we need Kawhi away from the action as much as possible. If you can have him away from the ball, that's a win. That was the genesis of it. So it's not like, oh, he's not playable in the playoffs. He's not playable versus the Clippers. It's like, here's how we can optimize his. And that's just my opinion on it. And the coaching staff might have had a different opinion, whatever. But I do believe that it was very difficult to involve him in the offense a lot in ways that were beneficial to him when Kawhi Leonard was guarding him, unless he was spaced out.
Bob was not afraid to have bold opinions about basketball. Porzingis was just one example of that. Anyone who used to follow him on Twitter can remember many others. So I asked Bob about the larger tension here, around not only his message, which he always backed up with evidence, but around him specifically as the messenger.
I think the thing I always think about, especially like the whole COVID team, is like someone like me, like the body, like I was like I created like an immune response for these basketball lifers. Like me being injected into their nervous system or the environment just like was like me, like I just, they, there's just something different about a guy who didn't play the game. That's not unique to me as a gambler. That's unique to analytics people in
general. Yes.
Nerds, whatever, nerds versus jocks. It's like kind of like a tale as old as time. it's very, and the one instant that I thought was the funniest, this was like peak dismissive Bob, I would suppose, was I'd been trying to convince people that Duncan Robinson was a player we should trade for, sign, whatever. There's no real chance that it was going to happen, so I just kind of forgot about it. But we're playing a game in Miami. We lose. Someone comes up to me with the box score, and Mark's right behind him. And like, did you see that? And I was like, did I see what? And I honestly had no idea what they were talking about. And he was like, 1 for 7. And I was like, 1 for what? What 1 for 7? Your guy, he went 1 for 7. He's never going to be an NBA shooter. I was like, well, who the fuck are you talking about? And it was Duncan Robinson. I was just like, are we having this conversation? This guy played like 20 minutes, took 7 NBA three-point shots. And I think the comment was like, sometimes you have to be willing to admit when you're wrong. And I was just like, look, I can admit when I'm wrong, but this is just nonsense to me. Like, we have reams and reams of data to show that this guy can shoot, not even just like, but just from film work. Like, a lot, I think a lot of the thing that I bristle at is this idea that I was this like spreadsheet jockey or whatever. Like, I watched a lot. And so just the idea that we would judge a guy on an NBA court on a three-point shot that has massive amounts of variance to begin with, like, had he gone 3 for 7, that would be great. Had he gone 2 for 7, that'd be, but he went 1 for 7. I was like, I can't deal with this. Like, I think my words were like, yeah, I can't deal with this. And I walked away. That's when it became obvious to me that it was personal to these people. Like, aha, look at this. By the way, they could have came up with lots of examples of players that I like that turned out to not be great. That's just, you're never going to be right all the time. So you want to be right just a little bit better than the average, or a lot better than the average. But even the best make a lot of mistakes and whiff. That's part of the deal.
Coming up, a behind-the-scenes look at the Mavericks' messy 2020 draft night and how and why Bob ultimately left the team.
Delicious meat, nutritious. In the snack that packs a real protein punch, Wonderful Pistachios, one of the highest protein nuts out there. Each 1 ounce serving has 6 grams of protein, giving you over 10% of your daily value. Trust me, I've been eating them like there's no tomorrow all week. Wonderful Pistachios also come in a variety of flavors and sizes, perfect for enjoying with your family and friends or taking them with you on the go. And you, like me, are on the go a lot, taking the kids to school, hopping from meeting to meeting, shopping for groceries, whatever it may be. Well, the good news is, not only are Wonderful Pistachios a complete protein providing all 9 essential amino acids, they're also great for all your adventures. So whether you're a pistachio purist who loves cracking open every nut, or you prefer the convenience of no-shells pistachios, Wonderful Pistachios has got you covered. Grab Wonderful Pistachios and elevate your snack game today. Visit WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more.
So, Bob, I wanted to ask you about this particular item in the Athletic story related to the 2020 draft in particular, because according to the piece, your vision did not align with others in Mavs management. It was, quote, a particularly egregious example of your power. And the evening was, quote, embarrassing. And the reporting says you did not consult scouts on the team's first 2 draft picks, which all paints a particularly telling picture of you and how you're perceived. So tell me how you experienced the 2020 draft and how all of that went down.
How it went down? A couple of Zoom meetings. Everyone kind of submits who they like. Everyone talks about who they like. You make notes of who they like. And so the way the draft went down, first of all, none of these guys were in the room.
By that, he means that those Maverick scouts were not actually physically in the room that day.
They are on Zoom, on a monitor, 35 feet away from everyone else. The way the day went, that wasn't a night, it was a day. It started very early, as they would start doing mock drafts. And they didn't stop until the sun went down, basically.
I don't understand that. What does that mean?
Donnie and be like, hey guys, let's do another mock draft. You be this team. Let's switch up the order of who gets to pick for who. So like someone like, I'm the Atlanta Hawks and I choose. And then they would do that over and they would do that over and over and over and over again. And I was like, this can't be real life in some ways. Like what is the purpose of this? Like that. Then there was a lot of talking with people who I respected in the, like there was a guy named Dave Pendergraf was there. Brilliant, hardworking basketball guy, respected his opinion a lot. The focus of the draft for me was to trade up to get Tyrese Haliburton. That was the focus of the draft. I'm not operating the phones. So I have no, I'm trying to impress upon Mark. This is the guy we need. Can we make this happen? What can we do? Donnie went up to his room office because his office was separate from everything. I'm assuming worked the phones. At this point, Pablo, you already know who everyone likes, who all the scouts like. And you also know who they think other teams like because they're doing a fucking mock draft over and over and over again, right? So the idea that I didn't consult any, first of all, I didn't know I was going to be running the draft. I don't think it was anyone's plan for me to be running the draft. But when it came time to pick 18, the general manager of the team wasn't around.
Wait, where was Donnie Nelson?
I don't know. He got very upset that I was there and that it looked like I was getting more attention from whoever, the owner or whatever. I don't know. I think he said to me, why aren't you the GM of the team? Why aren't you already a GM of the team? And I just bit my tongue. If I was like 25 years old version of me, the one that everyone thinks I am super arrogant, I probably said, well, probably because my dad was a degenerate gambler and your dad was fucking GM. That's the reason why we're not in this different spots. But I didn't say that. I just bit my tongue. I don't know. Like it was just a weird day. Like, yeah, look, nobody really went on the record. Like, oh, I like this guy. I don't like that guy. The idea of not consulting them before, first of all, I didn't know that I was going to be making a pick or anything like that. Like Mark's the guy, it's his team. You know, he's the owner of the team. He had faith in what the process that was going on, whatever it was. And it was kind of a weird day. By the way, I had a lot of empathy for this guy too.
This guy being Donnie Nelson.
Like, I'm not saying that because I'm on a fucking podcast or whatever, but like there wasn't a lot of communication as to what was happening. And he's trying to run the draft. And it was just kind of, look, these are stressful situations regardless of whether I thought, whether people want to think that this was a dysfunctional situation or not. They're stressful in general. You get 15 minutes to make your pick, whatever. But did I ask, why would I need to ask someone who they liked when I knew what he liked? Like an hour, did you change your mind in the last hour? Like what kind of new information could you have in the last 45 minutes or 30 minutes or 20 minutes? It was kind of nonsense. The whole idea that we know, oh my God, we should have picked someone else. First of all, that's really hurtful to the guy who's on the team, Josh Green.
Let's clarify because you guys end up selecting Josh Green, the guard out of Arizona at 18th overall. And in the second round, you take Tyrell Terry, the guard out of Stanford, who just got cut this month.
Correct. Yeah. Think about that for a second. Why are you working for an organization that's so eager to talk about how much you disapproved of the draft pick that we made? This guy's still under contract. He's 20 years old. He already used Luka as a weapon against me to get rid of me or whatever to paint me in a bad light. And now you decided to take a 20-year-old kid who is playing his first season, an abbreviated season, and try to seem like nobody wanted him but the nerdy gambler guy. It's bullshit. Nobody spoke up. Nobody said, oh, I really like Sadiq Bey.
Sadiq Bey, who was drafted by the Nets and then traded to the Pistons after the Mavericks picked Josh Green.
There wasn't a consensus among these scouts. That is just absolute fabrication. So I don't know, man. To answer your question, how it went wrong, I don't know. You're dealing with a bunch of people who are upset with the fact that someone else has the owner's ear and they don't. That's just kind of how these things work. You're always going to have people who disagree.
So I guess the question, Bob, now that you have sort of some distance from this, is how do you rate yourself on how you handled the interpersonal dynamics of running an NBA team or being involved in the running of an NBA team? Because you've just described some very complicated dynamics around ego and power and background. Like all of that is obviously combustible.
I mean, look, I'm an acquired taste. I get that. But I do think like there's a lot of people that I had great relationships with the Mavericks. I don't want to discount that. I still communicate with some of them now, just on a personal level. And yeah, I could have been smarter about it. If my goal was to win the Game of Thrones, I would have went, my goal was to make the team better. And at the point of the draft, I was already like, you know, kind of 1 foot up, kind of going back and forth as to whether or not I really wanted this. And that's not because I didn't want to work for Mark or I didn't want to work for, it's just like, it's just, it's just a lot. It's, I look at these guys, none of these general managers look particularly like they're living a great life. Like there's a lot of stress. They're all, like, every picture you see them is with three different phones. They're stressed out.
No, they're aging like presidents. Yes.
Yeah. And it's just not something that I needed. I mean, if I needed it, it was just to prove people that I could become one. That's more of what I think that is not a great, why should I care what people think? So how do I think I could do the job very, very well if I surrounded myself with people who believed in the ethos that I believed in, if I complimented myself with people who could help me in areas that I'm deficient in, if I attended some Tony Robbins seminar to help me with my people skills. I don't know. I like the way I am as a human being. I know that I have a lot. I'm very confident in my abilities to do things, but I'm also aware of the fact that, yeah, my personality is not for everybody. It's very polarizing. And so, you know, I don't think I'm unique in that regard in terms of people who are in positions of high level of success or wanting to achieve a high level of success. Agreeableness is, by the way, is a great precursor for success. Like lack of agreeableness is a giant precursor for success. So I like to think I'm more agreeable now than I was when I was younger, but I probably still could use a little bit of agreeableness training, if that makes sense.
Well, you mentioned before, though, how like one of Donnie Nelson's skills was the ability to stick around and build some sort of political base within the organization.
Brilliant skill. And I know I denigrated the fact that he benefited from some nepotism initially, but he is a guy who has clearly put in the work early on in his career. I mean, this guy was like coaching the Lithuanian national team. He's a coach in the NBA, an interim coach. He paid his dues. That being said, the game has changed a lot. So do I think Donnie was sitting there grinding away on computer modeling on how the game is changing? No, I don't think he was. But do I think that he had a lot of skill in terms of other things? Sure, yeah, probably. And he also was very good at keeping his job, which is a skill that clearly a lot of people, maybe people could say even me, I don't have. Like I'm not there anymore. Not that I wanted to be there. The way I saw it was anyone who was talented was and qualified was marginalized. And it was kind of an old boys network of guys who were just kind of there to kind of collect checks and stick around.
Well, let's get into Donnie's exit just as you saw it. I mean, how did you react when you saw that Donnie Nelson had been ousted effectively in June?
Yeah. I mean, I knew that it was going to happen. Well, okay. I was told that it was going to happen. It didn't catch me by surprise in any way. What caught me by surprise was that someone decided to strap a suicide bomb to their chest and take me out along the way. And I think they might have even been very excited about that fact, whoever the leakers of the story was, they might have been very excited. But they didn't realize that I did not care. I was not coming back. Like I had already said, I want to be let out of my contract. This isn't for me.
Well, it's to be clear, Bob, the suicide bomb you're describing is the article in The Athletic in which all of the stuff we've now exhaustively poured over became public.
And again, Donnie wasn't a source, but the idea that anyone would leak this story without, I don't know, I can't say I know for certain, but whatever. It's my belief that he probably very likely had some part in this, in addition to the other people that I was told had a part in it.
So Donnie gets officially relieved of his duties in June, very shortly after that Athletic report got published. But as for your standing, Bob, with Mark Cuban, the owner of the team, what kind of conversations were you having about what would come next for you?
I told Mark the day before the article came out and the day the article came, that I wanted to be let out of my contract. I had refused to sign an extension or at least to engage in it. Like, let's see what happens. And I'd already had overtures from other teams at that point anyways that I couldn't talk to because I was under contract till October 1st or September 30th. My last bit of correspondence with people in the front office were like, if this is going to work, you need to be able to do X, Y, and Z. And I was like, yeah, I'm not interested in doing X, Y, and Z because I don't really care. I don't want it to work. Like I'm living my life. I'm enjoying myself. I made it very clear to everyone that I had no interest in coming back.
Had you ever talked to Mark about one day becoming the guy running the team, the actual general manager?
I had not talked to him about that, but he had certainly talked to me about that for sure. But, you know, looking back, who knows? He may have had that conversation with five or six other people too. Like, I don't know what's going on. point is he knew that I was not long for the job in my current role. And I think one of the things I had said to him one day was like, I'm not waiting around to do this job. Like, if you think I'm going to sign another extension, like there's a better chance of me owning a basketball team myself. I want to make it clear that I have no problem with Mark Cuban. Like, do I think he runs an organization optimally? No. Do I think he's someone who I respect a lot? Yes. Here's a guy who is always trying to learn new things. I'd worked with Mark, who was really the general manager of the team anyways. Like, it's Mark's team. He is going to, I think now maybe that's changed. I don't know, from what I've read or heard or whatever in actual media reports, not privy to anything. But Mark's an alpha. He doesn't like the idea that someone else has more influence than him. I mean, he's the guy. It's his team. He bought the team. So I wasn't really dealing with the other people. It was all dealing with Mark. So, and I never, ever had more power than Mark. I never had more power than Coach Carlisle. I was just kind of around in the organization. Like, all these Mavericks fans who think I like caused all this chaos, like I'm the reason that Carlisle quit and da, 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 da. It's like, they're the same guys who were complaining over and over again how the team was stuck in the Stone Ages, and they were, you know, they needed to adapt, et cetera. Like, if anything, they should be happy that I came in there, and now they got a guy who's, by all accounts, great relationship guy, paid his dues, whatever, good person. Nobody has a bad thing to say about him. Maybe things are different now in the sense that it's more running like a traditional organization. So if I played a part in that, my chaos, then it seems like good chaos. Maybe I was an agent of good. I don't know. I don't see myself as being a chaos causer. Like, if causing chaos is trying to win games and doing so for the most part remotely, that's the part I think people are missing, then yeah, chaos causer by all means.
I wonder, Bob, when you think back to when you were growing up and you were a diehard basketball fan and you stumbled into betting on this sport and you obsessively watched it for decades and bet on it and made a fortune off of it. I'm wondering if the job that you got, as fraught now as we now fully understand it to be, I wonder if that was at one point a dream for you and if that dream has now been demystified since in some real way.
Definitely was a dream of mine. Now I don't. I mean, maybe I'll just settle for shadow GM. I don't know. Shadow GM's not too bad. I'll take that. Definitely not something I'm interested in right now. No. It is a arduous, all-consuming, low-reward, high-stress job. And I'd rather hang out with my doodle and do things like that. I'd rather travel and do other things. So would I go back and do it again? Probably not. But I'm grateful for the experience and the people I got to meet. Like, that's not as cliche as that sounds. It really is true. I mean, it's a cool story at the very least, and it's a cool experience. And but yeah, what am I going to be doing now? I don't know. I'm just trying to figure it out, you know, work on my people skills. I'm not sure. I went to a Phoenix Clippers playoff game. Yeah, I did. And I'll tell you what, Pablo, I used to love going to playoff games and sitting courtside. I went to this playoff game, sat courtside, and I felt like an outsider. It felt weird. And it felt like these players, these people, the immune response that they had for me kicked in. Does that make sense? Just the idea that I was a part of this league before and I'm no longer a part of it now. And the blowout was spectacular. It was pretty big news. I remember chilling in Mexico and trying not to, I turned my, you know, closed Twitter, wasn't watching social media. Butler comes in, turns the TV, and he's like, oh, look, it's Mr. Bob on the TV. And he's like, oh, they're saying some very bad things about you. It was kind of like, I was like, yeah, Jose, turn the TV off, please. I want to watch ESPN. So it was just kind of like, for a minute there, it felt all consuming, but now it's just kind of, if you can't laugh about it, what, you know, life's too short, live your life, enjoy it. You know, yeah, it was bizarre and surreal, but it's over. So that's the best part about it.
Bob Vulgaris, I just want you to know that I have greatly enjoyed you working on your people skills with me.
I appreciate that. Yeah, no, it's been fun. For sure. Appreciate you having me on.
I'm Pablo Torre, and this has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.